write, design, and publish their own chapbook, comics, zines, and art books. More information for the 2018-2019 programs at the IPRC can be found at iprc.org. Stay tuned.
Where is your radio dial on Thursday afternoons from noon until 2? 90.7 FM is the place to be. Twice a month, DJ Charlie presents the Worldbeat Connection with the hottest Afro-Caribbean sounds in Portland radio land. Reggae, salsa, soca, New Orleans Afro-funk, Haitian compa and rara, and Antillean zouk share the airwaves with African highlife, Afrobeat, Congolese soukous, Malian blues, juju, and South African kwaito, among the other great styles. Traditional and modern expressions are all included. On alternate weeks, check out Top Rankin' Reggae and Dancehall with Shocks of Sheba show, hosted by Teresa and Michelle. Any week, Thursdays at noon is sure to move ya.
About a decade ago, one of the most unimaginable, horrific events took place in Portland, Oregon. A woman threw her kids over the side of the Selwood Bridge. Now, that old bridge is gone and has been replaced with a new one, but the memory of that tragedy still lingers. Author Nancy Rommelman spent the past 7 years pursuing some kind of understanding as to why a mother would throw her own children into the Willamette River on May 23rd, 2009. Hello, I'm Denise Kowalczyk, and welcome to Between the Covers. I met with Nancy in the KABU studios to chat about her curiosity in understanding the multitude of layers to a very complicated story about Amanda Stott Smith, the mother who dropped those children over the bridge. We talked about trying to understand the unforgivable and looking at how family and friends dealt with the loss of Eldon and Trinity, and to a certain degree how they lost Amanda. And after reading thousands of pages of records and interviewing those closest to Amanda and the children, she wrote a book called To the Bridge, a true story of motherhood and murder.
So I was doing a little research on you and checking out your website, and you have this repertoire of types of offerings of books and so forth. So right. It ranges from your newest book, nonfiction, To the Bridge, A True Story of Motherhood and Murder, which we'll be talking about in a few moments, to novels like The Bad Mother,
right,
to a memoir. I mean, do you have a favorite? I mean, that seems such like an eclectic assortment of approaches to writing.
When I first started writing, when I became a journalist, I came to this point where I was like, gosh, am I a nonfiction writer or a fiction writer? Because even though I was concentrating on journalism and that's how I was making a living, you know, sometimes this fiction would pop out, including this little novel and, you know, a short story every once in a while. So I did put those out through a very a small imprint, small publisher that my sister-in-law had started a number of years ago, and that was great. However, I did realize quite a while ago that I am a nonfiction writer. That's where my, I guess, my heart lays. That's where I really like to do the long, long, hard work. And so I have another novel kind of halfway done in my computer? Sure. I think every writer, no matter what they write, does. But I am primarily a nonfiction writer.
So you touched on your background in journalism.
Yeah.
I would love to hear your opinion. I mean, we could probably spend an hour talking about this topic, but what are your thoughts on the state of journalism in our day right now?
Well, it's not what it used to be in terms of how we make a living and the outlets and what supports journalism, but that's how it is. The world's going to continue to turn, and we can be upset about it, but that's not going to do very much for good storytelling or for making money. So there are always new outlets, and people are going to continue to tell stories, and they're going to continue to want to hear stories. And you just find where you want to go, or you make the new way that you're going to go. For instance, my sister-in-law, Hillary Johnson, she started this small publishing company called Dimaxicon. She was putting out some different business books, which still do really well. And she's like, great. And that works. So I'm not gloomy about it. Actually, I'm super excited about the ways that we can tell stories now and the opportunities that we have and that we can make for ourselves.
It's just a matter of reframing. It's, I mean, the rate of change, the pace of change, whether it's technology or what else is happening in the world, there's still an opportunity. So that's really exciting to hear that, because usually I'm hearing more of the woe is us.
Gloom and doom. Yeah. What? No, I don't want to do that.
Yeah. Thank goodness we have folks out there dedicated to telling the stories.
Yep.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about the content of the storytelling. You tell some really intense, I'm not going to use the D word.
No.
The D-A-R-K
we'll
word.
We'll get into that later. Yeah.
But I actually wanted to touch base on that. The stories that you're sharing, there's this degree of heartbreak to it.
Sometimes, yeah.
Intensity. Why and how did that approach to the storytelling become important to you as a writer?
So when I started making a living as a journalist, it was 1994 in Los Angeles. And, you know, LA is a very interesting town. There's a lot of dreams that don't come true down there. So you have a lot of people and their pathos, and it is all on display. And I was very attracted to telling stories like that, you know, the old man bar downtown, or the Hollywood Motel, where people come to actuate a dream, and of course nothing happens, but 20 years later, they're still there. So, and I also wonderfully had the opportunity to tell these stories because I wrote for the LA Weekly for 20 years. So I really had a lot of breath, I had a lot of opportunity. As years have gone by, I will see a story reported that it's being reported in one way, and I think, no, that's not how it is. That doesn't seem to me at all to be the story, and I can feel that attraction. I know. It's like, okay, I have to find out what's going on here. And when you do that, you just start to, you know, you unpack things, and they can be painful. They can be scary. But I just really enjoy walking into a story where I want to try to make sense of what happened.
Curiosity must be the core.
For sure.
Yeah.
And tenacity when needed.
And you had a conversation with one of your colleagues about the dark, you know, telling the dark stories. Can you share a little bit about that?
Sure. So, it starts a little bit funny. So my dad's in assisted living, and I wanted to set up a reading on the East Coast for his crew there. And the event gal was great. And she said, sure, that'll be great. And my husband's like, you think you really want to read from the new book? It might be a little heavy. And the event gal felt as well, too. And I said to my husband, well, maybe I'll read that Modern Love piece I had, you know, in the Times last year. And he's like, you mean about your ex having cancer? And I was like, oh, man. So people do see this as dark. I am not crazy about the word dark, because to me it's shorthand, and shorthand for what? It also seems to me that it implies maybe that the writer is trying to be dark. And I can tell you for sure, I am definitely not trying to be that.
But life is about the lightness and the joy and the heartbreak and the so-called darkness, right?
Well, it's about, if you look at something and it's very difficult and it makes us afraid and there's a lot of anguish, absolutely, and you have to understand that and honor it and acknowledge that. But also when you open it up, we find out, how did this situation come to be? And I think by opening it up, I mean, some people could say you are shining some light on it. I just know I'm never trying to be dark. And so I'm not so crazy when someone says, oh, yes, you're such a dark writer. I don't think so at all.
Are you sort of bearing witness to some of this stuff?
Well, yes, I think so, though I find that very hard, if you can say that about yourself. I find it sounds a little maybe pretentious. But yeah, sure.
In a sense.
True.
Well, you have a new book.
I do.
It's called To the Bridge, A True Story of Motherhood and Murder.
Yes.
It's the story of Amanda Stott Smith. And can you fill it in, and as far as what this book is about? Because we're going to dig a little deep into this.
Sure.
But a little overview of what
it's about. Of course. So on May 23rd, 2009, Amanda Stott Smith drove to the Selwood Bridge in Portland, Oregon. And just after 1:19 in the morning, she dropped her two children into the river. Her 4-year-old son, Eldon, drowned. Her 7-year-old daughter, Trinity, screamed and screamed and was heard by many people along the river. And 40 minutes later, some Good Samaritans who lived on a floating home found her and rescued her. They also found Eldon at the same time he had died. And their mother, Amanda, was arrested about 9 hours later in a parking garage in downtown Portland, and eventually sentenced to 35 years.
I had just returned to living in Portland in 2008. So okay. I was here, and I remember that event, and I remember having to drive over that bridge many times to get my kid to school, and the flowers and the memorial that had stayed on the side of the bridge after that horrific event. So I do remember it, and it's I have to admit, when I was approached about reading this book and doing an interview, I'm like, I don't know if I can or want to, because I'm a mom.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to myself, right? And so I thought to myself, but Denise, I had a little conversation. There's a story. There's a big story behind this woman, Amanda, and her kids. And there was a certain degree of curiosity, and also a degree of, I need to wrap my head around. I want to understand this, or try to understand what could have been going on in that woman's head, and the impact that tragedy had on people and where they're at today. So I said, okay, I'm going to do it. And I started reading it, and a fascinating discovery of, talk about humanity and this woman. What about this story? What about Amanda's story and all of the other people involved in this compelled you to embark on this? Because it wasn't like you did a little research and wrote a book in a year. You dedicated some serious time to this.
Yes. I have written before about dead children. My mother once asked me, why do you keep writing about dead children? I was like, well, it seems important to do. I knew immediately upon seeing Amanda's photo in the Oregonian, it was the day or 2 days after the crime, I just said to myself, how does this happen? Because it doesn't make any sense. It just doesn't make any sense that a woman is going to drive to a bridge in the middle of the night and drop her kids off. So what do people do? They have two reactions usually. One is she's crazy, and the other is she's evil. You will have a few people that say, you know, we really have to understand mental illness, and we have pleas for that. But mostly the reaction is, you know, hang her from the Selwood Bridge, lower her slowly so as not to break the neck too quickly. People are angry. They need it over with. They don't want to hear about it. They don't want to hear about it in real life, in their community. They may listen to Serial or to Dirty John or to watch a TV show about true crime, but when it's close to home, no, I'm sorry. I needed to know. I needed to know as a journalist, basically, maybe as a mother. I'm sure that there was some appeal to that, because I knew I could not see myself ever doing that. I did spend a long time on the story for a couple of reasons. One, you're asking people to speak with you about the very hardest thing that has happened in their lives. And frankly, they don't want to. And I can certainly appreciate that. Two, it was a legal case that went on for a year, so people couldn't speak. Though her defender, Ken Hadley, was great, and he let me, without ever, you know, betraying his client, he was very, very helpful and very kind to me. I spent a long time with him. But the real factor, I think, in getting people to talk was after she was sentenced, which was just about a year after the crime. My phone and my email started to blow up with people needing to tell me what they knew and thought they knew. Because here, this woman that many of them had known the children, had just been sentenced, and they felt there was mitigating information that had not reached the public. And now they had no opportunity to tell what they knew. And so they were going to tell me. And I had a chorus of voices there telling me what they knew.
Now, that's interesting, because one of my questions for you is that I was reading, and this is through my filter of opinion on these people, is that they seemed apathetic, a little clueless on the signs, you know what I mean, of this woman when they knew her, whether it was childhood friend or college friend or later in life. And then it wasn't until like this terrible, terrible thing came into happening, that they were like, oh, a little reflective. Am I misinterpreting that?
Well, there's a lot. I think there's a lot of different POVs. It depends on, you know, who knew her when. You know, her college friends knew her as this bubbly, loving, a mother of a very young child, neither Eldon nor Trinity, her older son, Gavin, who she was raising by herself pretty much, though he had a father in the picture who took very good care of him, but he was in the Navy. So anyway, and they were not a couple in any case. And then they didn't really, you know, those the relationships fray. You knew someone in college, you were super close, then you're not 10 years, and things don't seem to be going so well in Amanda's life, but you've got your own life, and you're studying in Germany, or you've got your own kids, or whatever. I think you have to understand, too, that, you know, Amanda did change, and she was in a situation where she and her ex-husband were both pretty skilled at presenting, as presenting themselves as looking like something when it was very much not that. People in their families were confused. People in their families didn't feel that they could butt in. Social services came many times, and Amanda and Jason presented this wonderful picture. You know, I think we are quick to condemn social services and child services. You didn't do your job. What if you were paying attention? Well, if their own siblings and parents couldn't help and were involved all the time and couldn't figure out what was going on, it's difficult when you've never seen these people.
Right. Exactly.
I'm not saying things couldn't have been done. They certainly could have been done, but weren't.
What was the most surprising thing you discovered in your research working on this project?
That's a good question, Denise. I was surprised at some of the extreme behaviors that had gone in within that marriage that people were allowed to get away with for so long. You had some very, very skilled liars in the picture, and they were able to pull the wool over people's eyes for a very long time until Amanda decided that wasn't going to be happening anymore.
You know, I had a lot of trouble finding any bit of compassion for many of the people involved in this story, except, of course, the children. But looking at what Amanda, what you discovered through that research and that marriage and other relationships, I started to open that up a little bit to say, okay, well, I don't know the full story. And having to endure some of the experiences. Domestic violence, right? Emotional abuse?
Mostly emotional, I would say, abuse. Yes.
I'm wondering, did you have an opportunity to go a little bit further in her childhood to find out, was there something back there that was sort of the foundation?
I spent a lot of time with Amanda's grandmother. I probably met with her 8 or 9 times over the course of 15 months, and she told me a lot about Amanda as a young child. She played the piano beautifully, and she was a beautiful singer, and she was a great cook, and she was funny, and she was bubbly, and she was good at math. And, you know, she was very involved in the church. I did not find a particular trauma in her life, and I really don't think there's one answer that can explain. I mean, I think it would be super easy and satisfying for us to say, oh, there it is, now we know. But it's not. It's a confluence of people, you know, making one wrong turn and another wrong turn and another wrong turn, and now you're on the bridge in the middle of the night deciding that this is your option that you're going to take.
And that's an interesting point that you make, the confluence of people and confluence of activities. I'm a linear person, so I'm like, okay, let me just go down the list, figure this out, and boom. But it was interesting, a little shift, that's not how life works.
Well, but I don't know if this is if I'm saying the same thing or something different from you right now, but I can say that I was at all of her, or pretty much all, I was at all of her court appearances that were open to the public. And at the very end, her husband, or former husband Jason, stood up and said, you know, this crime will never make sense to anyone. And I thought, yes, it will. And it does. I mean, to me, it does. Of course, I've spent more time than anyone looking into this, I believe. but you can make sense. And as I said somewhere, nothing comes out of the blue. Nothing comes out of the blue. And this certainly did not.
Well, speaking of being at her court appearances and such, I'm hoping you might be able to read
sure
a portion of that, one of those
sure. I'm just going to read 38 pages here. No, I will not do that. I'm going to read you a very short section that happened on May 26th, 2009. So this was Tuesday. The kids were dropped from the bridge Saturday morning at 1:19 in the morning. So this was 4 days later. And I went to her first court appearance where she was going to be arraigned. Two guards led Amanda in. She wore a padded pine green vest, the prison-issued turtle shell given to those on suicide watch. She looked Native American, maybe. Her skin was a creamy coffee color, her cheekbones high and wide. Her thick, dark hair was loose and not untidy. She was not, as the TV cameraman had guessed, looking at the floor. She kept her face up and stared straight ahead, but her eyes landed nowhere in the room. The judge read the charges, one count of aggravated murder, one of attempted aggravated murder. The aggravated designation carried heavier penalties and, in this instance, indicated that the crimes were committed intentionally. If Amanda's case went to trial, she would face the death penalty. Amanda's attorney mentioned he was here as a courtesy to the family. It was unclear what this meant. I could not stop looking at Amanda, whose gaze remained unfixed. She looked as though standing were an effort, as though a weight on her shoulders was dragging her forward and down. The judge asked, "Do you understand the nature of the charges against you?" Amanda did not answer. The judge asked again, "Do you understand the charges against you?" This time, Amanda looked toward the judge. She appeared to move her lips. Everyone in the courtroom was waiting to hear what she said. What came out was, "Muh." At this, a syllable later interpreted in editorials by police and politicians as, "No one will ever understand how this happened," and, "No one could ever have seen this coming," Judge Philbrook issued her orders. Amanda Stott Smith would remain in custody until she reappeared on June 3rd. A guard took Amanda's elbow to escort her from the room. Amanda did not appear to understand the gesture. Another guard turned her, and she moved out the door as if moving through deep water.
Wow. I can't even imagine what was going through her head, her soul.
Yeah.
I mean, wow.
I do know, and we learn later in the book, that immediately, well, late in the day of the day that she dropped the children, she was visited by someone who I later interviewed, and he said that he thought she was completely out of it. I believe that she was with him, for sure. There are other things that I read about, in the police reports after she was taken. She didn't seem completely out of it, so I can't say.
Did you ever get to talk with her?
I did not get to speak with Amanda. I wrote to her many, many times. She would not speak with me. At first, I wasn't sure how that was going to work out, but it actually turned out to be completely in keeping with who she was. And had she spoken with me, that would have been fantastic, and it would have been part of the story, but her not speaking with me is also part of the story.
You did get to speak to her eldest son, Gavin.
I did get to speak with Gavin.
Do you keep in touch with him?
I keep loosely in touch with Gavin. I keep more in touch with his stepmother, Chelsea Beck, who had reached out to me fairly early, about a year and a half after the crime. Chelsea's been extremely involved in Gavin's life since he was, I believe, 6 years old. And she was really terrific. Actually, I've stayed in pretty close touch with a lot of these people in the book. I think that is a little unusual. I had an editor at the LA Weekly who once said, you burn a lot of bridges as a journalist, which is true. You enter a story, it's just completely consumes you, and then you go on, and they go on. Maybe because I was around for so long, maybe because it's such an intense story. I've stayed close with 4 or 5 people in this book. So,
wow. I wonder if the story will continue in some way, whether it's the healing or if Amanda will open up to talk with someone about something.
Well, the story for me already is continuing. I can't go too deeply into it, but there's someone in the book who I didn't get to speak with who reached out to me recently, and it is another arm of the story, and I promise I will tell you about it when it develops.
Wow. So, I'll be waiting on that. Yeah. Let me tell you. Did you find, or do you feel, or could you speculate, has anyone forgiven her?
Yes, Gavin told his stepmother, I've forgiven her. I had to forgive her to forget her.
And how old is he now?
20 or 21.
And how old is his her daughter, Trinity?
Her daughter, Trinity, would be... It was the 9th year anniversary recently of the crime, so Trinity would be 16.
Wow, teenager. Did you come up with a conclusion without... Maybe it's a spoiler for the book, but on what might have led Amanda to the bridge and to do this?
Yes. But as I said, it's not one reason. I think that she had her, with her permission in some senses, her identity kind of stolen inch by inch, everything that she had. Now, but you know, it takes two people to make a situation, you know. Nobody comes in and takes everything from you and you just go, okay, I'm helpless. She had things that she thought she could accomplish or maybe get away with or push forward that weren't going to happen, and then sub rosa things were getting taken. And I think she felt that she had nothing left, but she did have two things left. And she was going to use those two things to hurt Jason one more time. So there is an element of revenge to it. That was very, very quickly the story that was put out by the press. And that kind of angered me. I mean, that was put out by the press within a day. And I'm like, where did you... Wait, hold on a second. Where did this appear? Who said this? You know, I had to find out if that were true. I had to trace the roots of that. And I did come to the conclusion that is certainly part of it, but I think not all of it.
That was Nancy Rommelman, author of To the Bridge, A True Story of Motherhood and Murder. The book is being released in July with a reading on July 1st at 7 o'clock at Elder Hall in Portland. To learn more about Nancy, her book, and her work, visit her website, www.nancyrommelman.com. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Between the Covers. I'm your host, Denise Kovalchuk.
Proud to broadcast the 31st annual Waterfront Blues Festival, taking place from July 4th through 7th at Waterfront Park in Portland. KBOO will be broadcasting the festival from noon to about 10 p.m. every day, and will be broadcasting throughout the state on Oregon Community Media radio stations from Ashland and Astoria to Warm Springs. Again, that's the 31st annual broadcast of the Waterfront Blues Festival, taking place July 4th through 7th, noon to 10 p.m. or so, every night at Waterfront Park in Portland and on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Ryan.
Attention, people.
Welcome to the film show on KABU. I'm SW Conser, and I'm joined live in the studio today by a celebrated film historian who's recently relocated from San Francisco to Portland. Elliot Levine, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Good to be here.
And so we'll be asking you all about the new series that you're curating, Cold War Shivers, Sci-Fi Scare Films of the 1950s, in just a few minutes. But first, I am joined by Maria Allred. Maria is a first-time feature filmmaker. Her debut is called The Texture of Falling. It's playing at the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry, their Empirical Theater. Yeah, and it's actually, you can catch it this evening, Thursday the 28th. There's more information at omzi.edu. And co-producer Damien Girardi is also here in the studio. Maria and Damien, it's great to have you on the show.
Thanks so much for having us. We're so excited to be here.
Well, the two of you wear many hats. You're actors as well as filmmakers. Mm-hmm. And Damien, you're well known for your art photography.
Yeah, that's correct. Before I got into film, that was what I was doing. I was shooting portraits of rock stars and artists for magazines.
Yeah,